we didn't have our food drive, so I'm looking at my pantry right now, and I've got like 90% of the shelves are empty.
Alaska Charities report a high need this holiday season. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 25th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Keegan Randall trains to win a medal at this year's Winter Olympics, but there's a twist.
Oh, of course there's a little bit, kind of where you go, oh darn. But the Olympics are all about seeing what you can do.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by AlaskaDispatch.com, reporting from across the state using multimedia and citizen journalism online to tell the story of our state. Find your Alaskan news at AlaskaDispatch.com.
Anchorage homicide cases that have remained unsolved for years are currently getting a thorough review. That's thanks in part to a federal grant that is providing resources for DNA evidence testing and staff time to pore over the files. APD Sergeant Slav Markowitz is the head of the Homicide Detective Unit. He's a 20-year law enforcement veteran and says of between 50 and 60 cases that are being reviewed, 28 have been assigned for further investigation. DNA evidence analyzing techniques have improved greatly in recent years, and Markowitz says the federal money allows them to send evidence to a lab in Salt Lake City for examination.
I think we've sent evidence in 3 or 4 cases so far, and there is more to come. We are still in the process of reviewing evidence and deciding which would be good evidence to send.
Markowitz says the Utah lab is one of the top in the nation for processing DNA evidence. Alaska has a crime lab in Anchorage, but its first priority is current crime evidence examination. Markowitz says although he can't talk about specifics of the cases, they will be looking for help from the public.
So what may be happening now is as we are reviewing cases and we are looking at DNA, we may also want to contact some witnesses or find out if there are any additional witnesses.
Many of the names will be remembered from news accounts in the past. Genevieve Tetpond was found stabbed to death along Arctic Valley Road near the Fort Richardson Gate in March of 2000. Another is Louis De Jesus, who was killed at the Anchorage VFW Club in 2002. Others date back much farther. Markowitz says many times relationships change, and people who were previously unwilling to come forward may now want to tell what they know.
Allegiances change and relationships change. If someone, for example, had a girlfriend or boyfriend 10, 15 years ago, they are no longer together and they have important information, you know, they may be willing to tell us now. Sometimes these relationships went sour. And you also, when you get information from an ex-spouse or, you know, ex-friend, you have to consider that also, that, you know, is it good information or is it just somebody trying to get back at somebody?
Sergeant Markowitz says often when a suspect talks about killing, it crosses a line, and even criminals in jail that would not care about a lesser crime won't stay silent about murder.
Well, if someone is doing burglaries or thefts, that doesn't offend them that much, but when they hear that this person killed someone, a lot of people are offended by that or even scared that line was crossed, and they are more willing to share that information. And also as they mature, as they get older, they also may be willing to say what they know.
He says they give all the cases equal merit, and APD's solve rate at 88% to 90% is much higher than the national average of 57% to 60%. Anchorage averages 15 to 20 murders per year. Markowitz says national databases exist for DNA, fingerprints, and even shell casing characteristics. One murder case that had no good leads for more than 13 years was assisted when DNA evidence from the crime was added to the national database, the combined DNA Index System, or CODIS, network. The killer was located on the East Coast, arrested, and sent back to Alaska to stand trial. Markowitz says people who were afraid to come forward before should not fear getting in trouble now for their reticence. He says even the accused have the right to remain silent, so deciding now to talk to police about a past crime will not result in legal trouble. Links to details and pictures of many of the cold cases are at our website, aprn.org.
Thank you.
Anchorage cross-country skier Keegan Randall just missed the podium in her first international race of the season. She placed fourth in the 5-kilometer skate and ninth in the classic sprint earlier this month in Norway. The two-time Olympian is a skate sprint specialist who has been working hard to improve her classic technique in preparation for the Vancouver Olympics in February. She's hoping to become the first U.S. cross-country skier since 1976 to win a medal. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
Keegan Randall has been focused on this February's Olympics for a long time, almost a decade, in fact, according to her mom, Deborah.
It was really fun. She and her friend, her best friend in high school, they were sitting in Keegan's room their senior year in high school, and I'd given them these memory books, and so they were plotting their goals for the future. And in that goals was the Olympics in 2002, because she was still in high school, and then ultimately 2010 to win a medal.
By high school, Randall was an accomplished cross-country skier, but her mom remembers a day when the budding star struggled with her form, if not her determination.
You know, I used to laugh at her at Junior Nordic because she was not a very good skier, but she would clamber to the front with, you know, poles flying, skis flying every which way, but she had to be in the front.
On a recent morning near Anchorage, those poles and skis hit the snow with elegant precision. Denali glows pink in the distance. Dozens of moose are munching on alders nearby. It's a beautiful Alaska scene, but Keegan has other things on her mind.
I'm thinking about every stride, making it as efficient as I can. So a lot of the moment-to-moment stuff is just thinking about, okay, hips here, arms here, feel this movement, feel that movement, quick kick, you know, lots of just things that I'm thinking about my technique.
Keegan is a specialist in the skate sprint. She's won a World Cup race in the event and placed second last year at the World Championships. But she hasn't had that same podium success yet with the classic technique. That's something she'll have to work on if she's going to win a medal in Vancouver. The sprint race switches each Olympics between classic and skate. 2010 happens to be a classic year, but Keegan isn't intimidated.
Oh, of course there's a little bit kind of where you go, oh darn, you know, it would have been nice to go in, especially after the silver medal at World Championships last year, to go in really firing for a skate sprint. But a classic sprint is a big challenge, and the Olympics are all about seeing what you can do.
Keegan's coach, Eric Flora of Alaska Pacific University, is doing everything he can to prepare her for that challenge. In the dungeon-like basement of APU, she powers through an intense workout he's mapped out on his laptop. During this exercise, she's hopping on and off a series of boxes. The last one looks impossibly high, as tall as a desk, but Keegan easily lands on top.
Didn't that box used to intimidate me?
Yep, I was just thinking that.
Every summer, Keegan and the rest of the APU skiers train on a glacier above Girdwood. Flora remembers one tough session last summer when he realized an Olympic medal was within Keegan's reach. She had just finished a hard workout of hill repeats. He acknowledged her effort and then turned his attention to other athletes.
I turned around and there was the men's team was skiing up the hill and they were about halfway through the repeat. And I watched Keegan jump in right behind him and try to race the men up the hill. And she stuck right on with him and charged up the hill. And What I see in that is she's looking for another way to get that next step. I think that's what sets her apart.
U.S. cross-country skiers have been ignored at international competitions since Randall was just starting out in the sport. But she's never let that attitude affect her. Her mom, Deborah, says it's an outlook that's allowed Keegan to take U.S. skiing to a new level.
You kind of get lulled into this false sense that Americans will never be as good as anybody else because we've never been able to do that. And, you know, Keegan, as always said, I'm going to do it. And I just couldn't, I guess I was skeptical. It's like, Keegan, you know, this is, you know, we're talking Norwegians, we're talking Russians here. How are you ever going to compete against that? She has never wavered in her belief that she could do it.
Keegan Randall isn't the only U.S. cross-country skier who has a shot at a medal in Vancouver. The team has strong contenders in at least two other events. And now Keegan hopes they can woo a few more fans to a sport that has often been dismissed by people in the lower 48.
Cross-country skiers always get a rap for being kind of boring, disappearing off in the woods for an hour and coming back. So I thought I'd spice things up a little bit, just have a little fun.
That spice she's referring to is hair dye, stripes of hot pink running through her wavy blonde hair. So she'll be hard to miss in Vancouver, especially if she ends up on the Olympic podium. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Fite.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Norvik residents learn native dancing after the village voted to lift a century-old ban.
We have, you know, like about 70, 80 kids on the floor from our village, down on the floor, just dancing, stomping away, you know.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The village of Norvik has voted to allow native dancing in the community for the first time since missionaries banned it in the early 1900s. The town of about 500 people is on the Kobuk River near Kotzebue. It will be the first community counted when the U.S. Census kicks off in late January. Leaders in the town want to welcome dignitaries from Washington, D.C. with traditional dancing, sled dog teams, and a cultural exhibit. Bobby Wells is mayor of Norvik. He says during the debate over allowing native dancing, some elders in the community spoke out against it.
It was really hard to turn them over, you know. Until today, they sort of like soften up, and some of them are still, you know, still hard. But I believe that, you know, with understanding and patience and the scripture just the same, that they can change, you know, because dancing brings freedom of spirit and, you know, an expression to the Creator, and that wonderful songs and stories out of dancing. And that's what they need to know, is that this is not shaman dancing we're trying to do here in the community now, today, you know.
And so what has the general reaction been in the community? You mentioned that there's still some folks who are opposed. What's the conversation like in Norvik now about this?
I believe if you go out there, I'm thinking maybe at about maybe 85 to 95% of it will say, that's good, do it. You know, a lot of, even a lot of the elders are excited about it. There's elders on it as well today that say, do it. And a lot of these elders are individuals who have not been so active in the church, but yet still understand what it means to dance and to express your freedom. And my guess is probably not even maybe 20 altogether in the village that are going to stand up strong against this.
How are residents learning to dance again in Norvik?
The team that came out of Kotzebue, they got some songs, and we have, you know, like about 70, 80 kids on the floor from our village, down on the floor, just dancing, stomping away, you know, and learning the dance from the instructors. So kids, and some of them are adults, and, you know, they want dancing, you know. They enjoy it. This young student expressed herself saying, if there's no dancing, I got no life, you know. I lived a rough life as a young child, and this is setting me free now.
What do you think can be learned from this experience for Norvik's younger generations? You went from engaging in traditional activities, a traditional life that stretches back generations, to ending it because of outside influence, and now it's coming back. How do you want younger people to see this in 10 or 20 years? What do you think is learned here?
Well, I believe the real most important thing that I'm seeing through this is cooperation, is understanding for all the parties, including the elders, those who live that old lifestyle. And today, the kids, the younger generation, and, you know, today is a different world. It's not the same as yesterday. You know, that Western civilization is taking over. And, you know, yet still that doesn't mean we should forget our culture, our history. We need to keep it alive. We need to keep it strong within ourselves, you know, to have an identity so that we know who we are and we're more ready to accept tomorrow and the changes that are coming.
And Mayor Wells, will you be one of the people out there dancing?
Oh, I'll tell you what, every chance I get, you know, I get out there and I do my best, you know, I enjoy it. Even though I get some looks, you know, some questionable looks, you know, from some of my friends. You know, I just get out and enjoy it and express my freedom.
Bobby Wells is the mayor of Norvik. The census count begins on January 25th. Southeast groups serving low-income and homeless people say the needs are greater this holiday season. Despite improvements nationwide, the economy is still hitting many residents hard. Holiday food collections are having mixed success, and most are asking for continued donations. Costa Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The worst of the economic recession has bypassed many Southeast residents, but some at the lower end of the income range have seen increasingly hard times. United Way of Southeast Executive Director Brenda Hewitt says the need for assistance is up 15% to 20% this year. One reason is that people are moving around in search of work that isn't there.
We are seeing more people coming to the cities because they're not having work in the rural areas. They think that they're going to be able to find jobs in the city, and they aren't necessarily there. Or they find out that times are a little tougher than they thought.
The movement isn't just from villages to cities, it's also from the lower 48 to Alaska. Dave Kyle heads up Wrangell's Salvation Army Corps.
I have dealt with three or four people that have come to Wrangell expecting to find work. I've dealt with at least two that just looked us up on a map and said, I want to go there. And I got to ask them, did you... call the Chamber of Commerce before you came up here.
The Rasmussen Foundation has already sent extra money to some of the region's Salvation Armies to help boost food and other programs. Dozens of other churches, shelters, and service groups have also been collecting and delivering groceries for Thanksgiving drives as well as regular assistance programs. Success has been mixed. A week before Thanksgiving, the Glory Hole's Maria Levishuk was still looking for holiday supplies.
We need canned goods such as canned green beans and canned corn, when we have no cranberry sauce at all. And we don't have stuffing. We're actually going to make stuffing. I'm having the staff make stuffing, too, out of our old bread.
Donations poured in over the weekend, but more were still needed. The Kluwak Salvation Army also reported coming up a little short. The Corps' Ronnie Davis says the group supplies regular boxes of groceries to about 70 families on Prince of Wales Island.
The food that we have in our food pantry normally would go to that to enhance what we get from the Food Bank of Alaska. But this year we didn't have our food drive, so I'm looking at my pantry right now and I've got like 90% of the shelves are empty.
Wrangell's Salvation Army also ended up with fewer canned goods from this year's drive, which involved scouts and school groups. But Kyle of the local Corps branch says that's still enough because the town's needs have changed.
We have fewer people coming in with an increase of food to each individual. So overall, we're coming out okay. The Lord's working it out that it all comes out in the end. So we're not hurting bad. We just have to adjust the way we do things.
Cash donations and organizations' meager savings usually fill whatever gaps are left in holiday food boxes. And if there are leftovers from Thanksgiving drives, they go towards Christmas deliveries and community meals. Hewitt of the United Way says groups always seem to find a way to help those in need.
In living in some of the smaller communities in Southeast, I just remember that if there was a family and you knew that they were hungry, they ended up with food. And that's just sort of an Alaskan tradition.
As Thanksgiving preparations wind down, Christmas drives gear up. The Salvation Army has its Angel Tree program, where donors are matched with children whose families can't afford gifts. Other groups are collecting jackets, gloves, heaters, and toiletries for homeless people trying to make it through the winter. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the new AT&T, your world delivered,
and by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future.
The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
A group of residents in Bethel want another vote on alcohol. Sponsors of a new petition are unhappy with the outcome of the previous election, when Bethel voters revoked local option laws. Now, 9 Bethel businesses are applying for a liquor license. That includes 7 restaurants and 2 package stores. Bethel resident Anna Hoffman spoke before the Bethel City Council at their last meeting. She and other supporters packed the council chambers.
The 27 petition sponsors are here, and we are moving forward with our petition to return Bethel to damp status.
Bethel was damp for more than 30 years before the October municipal election. Damp allows for the importation and consumption of alcohol, but not the purchase or sale of it. Petition sponsors say they hope to have enough signatures by the end of the year to put the question on a ballot before the Alcohol Control Board has time to approve any liquor licenses within the city. The Governor's Rural Action Subcommittee held a public meeting in Dillingham earlier this week to get the input of local residents on ways to improve life in rural Alaska. KDLG's Mike Mason was there and filed this report.
6 members of the Governor's Rural Action Subcabinet were joined by the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities during Monday night's hearing in Dillingham, which came on the heels of a similar meeting Monday afternoon in Naknek. The first person to address the rural subcabinet was Dillingham Mayor Alice Ruby, who noted that Dillingham is a first-class city that acts as a regional hub.
The services Dillingham provides is a K-12 school system, a 24-hour police service, water and sewer, state-certified landfill, street maintenance, Altai Dock, Boat Harbor Library, Museum, fire and ambulance, senior citizens program, planning, and on. We're really a city comparative to some much larger. The citizens, some of them have approached me and said, we're taxed to the max. Dillingham attempts to be as self-reliant as possible. We do that by taxing ourselves heavily.
Ruby stressed to the members of the Rural Action Subcabinet that Dillingham residents are starting to buckle under the strain of the high taxes necessary to keep the city running.
For 2 years in a row, the city has had to budget, out of our savings in order to preserve what we have. It's true for citizens as well as municipal operations. The city's energy costs have increased 30% over 5 years. There's also a skyrocketing cost of health insurance, more demand for services, and generally just the cost of living in rural Alaska. It's extreme. Dillingham also deals with some of the same issues the larger communities do, and that is that many in our villages are moving to Dillingham because there are jobs, there are services. And many people in Dillingham end up moving to the higher area, the higher population areas. But Dillingham then is forced to try to serve, more people with existing services.
Ruby confirmed that the city strongly supports the commercial fishing industry in Bristol Bay. And because of that commitment, the city has taken positions in opposition to the proposed Pebble Mine and offshore oil and gas exploration and development. She told the assembled commissioners that the risks are simply too great to allow such projects and activities to go forward and threaten the industry that helps support Dillingham. The second person to speak Monday night was Carolyn Smith, the mayor of Alignagik. She stressed that the city of only 245 people struggles with high energy costs and other energy-related factors.
We really struggle with the issue of getting fuel to the village, even though we are connected by road to Dillingham. Crowley had said that they would not come and provide fuel to the North Shore, and we had to make special arrangements so we could get a tank truck, put a tank truck in a landing craft, get it to the North Shore, and then try and safely get it around on the North Shore to deliver fuel this fall. It was a real challenge, but the cost is really high as well.
Around 50 Dillingham area residents showed up for Monday night's hearing of the Governor's Rural Action Subcabinet, and around 15 people actually testified. The subcabinet is chaired by Attorney General Sullivan, and at the end of the meeting, he said the state wants to develop working partnerships with cities, tribes, and organizations that serve the people of rural Alaska.
There's no silver bullet, obviously. There's no something that's going to happen overnight. But we'll continue to press. We really appreciate the input.
The subcabinet will be preparing a report for Governor Parnell in advance of the start of the Alaska Legislature's next session early next year. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The Interior Department announced today it's launching a new effort to create a policy on tribal consultation. It comes in response to an order earlier this month by President Obama to improve the federal government's nation-to-nation relationship with tribes. Officials say the new policy will be developed with input from the country's 564 federally recognized tribes. In order to get tribal leaders' feedback, Interior officials plan to visit various cities in the next 2 months, starting with Anchorage next week. The department's spokeswoman for Indian Affairs, Nedra Darling, says participation from tribes is critical.
What we will be doing is looking at a consultation action plan that respects tribal sovereignty, self-governance, self-determination, and maximizes tribal input and coordination. So we really need and are hoping that people will come and bring their comments on how we can improve our actions.
Next week's meeting in Anchorage is on Wednesday at the Egan Center. It's the only Alaska meeting. Darling says they hope to hear from leaders how the federal government can do a better job working with tribes on policies that affect them.
We want to solicit input from the tribes themselves, but some things that the comments might include could be what federal actions of the department should initiate consultation, and at what point in the process should tribes be involved and participate. How far in advance should the department and its bureaus give notification of consultation? Who should participate in the consultation, and how should it occur?
The Interior Department is on an intense schedule to take input. 3 weeks ago, President Obama issued a memorandum giving his cabinet secretaries 90 days to develop a plan for improving consultation with tribes. Darling says that means the Interior Department wants public comments by January 15th so it can develop its plans in early February. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Communications Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
And by
Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. Help manage subsistence hunting and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The deadline to apply is January the 8th. For more information, call 800-478-1456. This announcement is sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Subsistence Management.
Regional Council Lanun Una 800-478-1456. Application not humchikut January 8th army. Unakan kigun khtuk U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Office of Subsistence Management, Anchorage.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.